Hello and welcome to Ditching Hourly. I'm Jonathan Stark. Today I am joined by guest Barry Van Someren. Barry, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jonathan. Thank you for having me.
Did I get the pronunciation right?
Yeah, you did.
Oh, good for me.
Yay. Yeah.
Well, today we're going to talk about tax laws. No, it's going to be much better than that, I promise. But first, Barry, could you tell folks a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. I'm Barry. I've been a long-time listener of your podcast. I live in the Netherlands, so you may pick up a little bit of an accent. I started out freelancing like probably a lot of your listeners did by doing hourly work and slowly transitioned into products and services, mainly by listening to your show and your podcasts or reading your books.
My apologies.
And I happened to do this right around the time back in 2016 when the tax code in the Netherlands changed, and that's part of what we're going to talk about today, I believe.
Yeah, that would be interesting. So before we get there, can you tell folks a little bit about the specifics of the transition? So it's very nice to hear that I've had some effect on that, a positive effect. But what was that like for you? What caused you to even consider making a change? You know, were you experiencing dissatisfaction with hourly?
Yeah, so initially I was working a lot of hourly for just one client, and you probably know what that's like. You have a contract for half a year, you don't spend a lot of time doing sales, then the contract runs out, panic, you have to find something else. So I wanted to transition into something that was more predictable. And right around that time, you had a podcast, and I forgot who it was about, but it just clicked that I should have services or products. And I was doing system administration services and hosting a little bit. I figured I'd go higher end and turn this into something that's built on a monthly basis rather than on the hourly basis, along with extensive automation, which I've been improving over the years, would reduce the number of hours I would need to work per client to meet their results. And I did.
And you did. Fantastic. And so what is that? What kind of business is it? Just to give people a flavor.
Yeah, so I generally support companies that build their own Java applications. I used to be a Java developer, but nowadays I do mostly ops work, Kubernetes, cloud native, that sort of thing. What I basically do is my clients build it and I make sure it keeps running online. It keeps trends running, so to speak. And I've been doing this hourly for about 50% of my time for a few government clients. And I also have a few smaller clients that generally have two or three developers on staff, but nobody to handle the infrastructure. And that's kind of the sweet spot I wriggled myself into.
Nice. Great. And in your, can you share your pricing model? You said it's monthly and per client. Is it the same price for all clients, for the ones that aren't hourly?
It's pretty close. I try to find clients that need similar amounts of support and infrastructure. So in general, it's close. I am working towards a product at a lower price point that's more automated and for smaller applications, because clients I'm hosting now generally have 10, 20 VMs for a project. So they tend to be a bit bigger. And I kind of also want to serve some applications that you would put up from Heroku to start with, kind of that size.
And how do you find these clients?
Well, a lot through my network. I do have to work on my sales, which technical people like me are shockingly bad at, unfortunately.
So that's great background. I think a lot of people can, that'll resonate with a lot of people listening. So the sort of genesis of this phone call, this episode, was that you emailed and said that there's new tax code. I don't remember what year you said it was, but you just mentioned it, came along that would potentially classify independent contractors as employees, which would then...
Let me just give you a very short rundown. Some things are also different in the Netherlands than in the US. So in the Netherlands, if you're an employee, you get all sorts of benefits. For example, if you get sick or if you're out of work, you pay into the system. Freelancers, if you have your own business, do not pay into the system. Now, way back, and we're talking 20, 30 years ago, somebody was operating as a freelancer. They lost their job, or at least the client no longer had work for them. And they successfully sued for wages because technically they were really an employee. So what happens, the government does what the government usually does. They initially created a law that forced you to kind of, well, you didn't have to, but in general, it meant you had to tell the tax or the IRS, this is what I'm doing with my business. Please tell me I'm not an employee and that for this year I'm operating as a company. The system worked somewhat, but it never really gave you any guarantees. So sometimes the IRS would audit you and decide, well, you really are an employee. Nobody liked this. So in 2016, they set out to change the law again. And they specified a few indicators that mean you're an employee or if you're running a business. And a few of these things are, do you take risk? Do you take kind of orders, or does your client tell you how to do your job? And that was basically what triggered me to send that email. Because that was one of the very strong indicators whether you're an employee or not. You mentioned this, you touched upon that in your email, and I thought it was a very nice point.
Yeah, there is a very similar sounding law in California, I think. Went into effect in 2019, and there's three criteria that independent contractors have to meet in order for the employer or whatever the payer to not have to classify them as an employee. And it's similar to what you just said. It's like, you know, does the independent contractor have their own business entity? You know, are they incorporated or something like that?
Important one.
Yep. Does the buyer tell the seller what to do, like how to do their job, like you just said? And there's another one. I think it's that the nature of the work is different from the core work of the business.
Yeah. So it definitely sounds like they checked each other's homework.
Yeah.
So that's very similar. I believe those three things are the main points, but there was a recent lawsuit regarding a company that operates a lot like Uber Eats in this country. And I believe the court has now decided on 9 different things that I'm not going to bore you with. But the most important ones are the ones you mentioned. So definitely does the client tell you how to do your job? That's a very important one.
Agreed.
So this law has been on the books since 2016. There was a lot of outcry about this. So what happens, they decided not to enforce it and slowly introduce the enforcement of this law. First only taking those that really, really are breaking the law. So one of the things, we had people delivering food for Uber Eats and other companies. They would be employed before this, and then the company would decide, hey, I can just get you as a contractor and pay less taxes.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how the system was abused. So there's definitely a good reason for this. The problem is that when they make these laws, they apply to everybody, and it just causes a big mess.
Right.
And they decided not to enforce this law right up until January this year. And then when it became obvious that nobody was going to flinch in this game of chicken, a lot of people lost their contracts at the end of the year.
Right. Yeah, because, right. So for gig workers like Uber drivers, or like you said, Uber Eats drivers, or it's meant to protect them, and it makes sense. You know, it's like, okay, so that's, but like you said, it affects everyone. So people who don't want those protections. So the seller in this case, like let's say the consultant, I wouldn't want my clients to be responsible for my unemployment insurance or something like that.
Yeah.
And that would make it, and if they were, or even were afraid that they were, that would make it much more difficult for someone like me to close deals. So it's, you know, probably good for the average Uber driver, but it's really bad for anybody who's kind of like a independent consultant or, I think it's very easy. If you are a consultant in name only, I talked to a lot of people. And in fact, this was me for a couple of years where I sort of got the memo, you know, don't call yourself a freelancer, call yourself a consultant and you can charge more. But what I didn't realize at the time and what lots of people don't realize is you can't just change the name. They're actually different. It's a different thing. Or let's not say freleancer, let's say contractor, let's say independent contractor. So if someone is a really good Java developer and there's some startup that's got this product that's built in Java and they need tons of Java developers and they hire you to write code, that would be dangerous.
Yes.
And
that became more dangerous now over here.
Right. And by dangerous, I mean,
tax wise.
Yes. Well, like you said, it's fairly likely that you'll get fired or you'll lose the contract because the employer doesn't want to pay your taxes. And it's crazy because the Java developer probably doesn't want the business paying their taxes either, but it's like, you know, what are you going to do? So those three things, at least it sounds like in California and in the Netherlands, being incorporated, having multiple clients, having obviously a going business concern, would perhaps calm down your buyers, right? So if here's the problem, like I feel like I'm not doing a great job articulating the problem. The problem is you go into a sales meeting with a potential client and they want to hire you, or they're thinking about hiring you, and they're like, well, you know, but we're afraid that you're going to end up taxed like you're an employee. And then has this sort of chilling effect on all contracting of any kind.
Yeah, but there are ways of dealing with this. And the interesting thing that I've noticed with all the clients I still have for hourly work is because it's not forbidden to hire somebody even for a longer term to do a certain job. But now you have to be specific about the results you're going to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
Even better if the results aren't hourly, but yeah, not every client is ready to go that way. But you basically have to decide together what is the result we're going to achieve, rather than starting hourly work and just seeing where you'll end up. And this nicely aligns with your message that you've been talking about for years, I believe.
Yeah. If they're bossing you around, you're not a consultant.
No, exactly. And a lot of times projects start, you hire that Java developer and you just start writing code without thinking about, so what is it we're trying to achieve? What's the end goal?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's the nice thing about the work I do. I generally know what the end goal is and the client also knows, and we can package this into a price point that works for both of us.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit harder as a Java developer, but nothing prevents you from doing one or four smaller projects, right?
Right. So how would you, what name do you use or label do you put on the non-hourly things that you do? So do you call it like a maintenance agreement?
It kind of is. Yeah.
Okay.
And in my case, it's kind of complicated as well, because I generally also host the application. So I have my own infrastructure, my own mini cloud, so to speak. And I do the Apple model where you get the software and the hardware together.
Mm-hmm.
So I consider that a product with a service.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what you'd consider it. It's not the standard freelancing approach to work, but it works well for me
right
and my clients.
And what's the what's the promise you make on the service side? So we can probably guess, you know, uptime and so forth on the hosting side, but what's the promise on the services side?
A big selling point is predictability. So in a world where everything's being paid for by the hour, consultants or support, you pay hourly for everything. What clients find it refreshing that I'm willing to say you pay in the app, you get all the resources you need within some bounds, of course, and all the support you need. After the initial shock wears off, you start the discovery phase, you talk about how you're going to set this up, and it turns out generally you have a good idea what needs to be done, and if you're very specific about the problems you solve, you now solve them. You're the expert, right?
Right. Yes, exactly. Preaching to the choir.
And all of that ties in very nicely with new tax codes. All of the stuff I do, my clients aren't worried about whether the label would stick or not, because I obviously operate as a company selling a service.
Right.
I don't have these discussions.
Yeah, that was my next question is, like, did you have to have a discussion with, like, did they all get freaked out and send you an email like, oh, this law is going into effect, you know?
Only the hourly clients, because obviously they are under scrutiny, and some of them are government as well, or semi-government. So obviously they have to do right. And we did. Basically, all the contracts were up for renewal, and we went with project-based contracts where we decide together what kind of project we're going to do, add results to them. And technically, if I don't deliver the results, then I can't bill for the time either. So there's more incentive of making sure you actually deliver.
Right.
Which I think is fair.
Right. Yeah, as long as you're confident that you can, you know, if you want to take that risk.
Sure. Yep.
I mean, if you took your car in to have the brakes fixed and they spent 10 hours working on it and you get the car back and the brakes still aren't fixed.
Yeah.
You would not expect to pay for their time, even though they spent the time.
Yeah.
What else do people need to know about this? I guess a big takeaway here is for people to be prepared for the potential conversation if they're operating in an area where this could come into play. And actually, the California thing, I don't know. Maybe you know, at least in your case, in the Netherlands, does it matter where the seller? Does it matter where the seller is or where the buyer is? Like, which law applies? I would imagine it's the
buyer.
That's
a good question. So maybe talk about the risks more. So if you're not compliant with this law, basically the IRS will treat you as if you're an employee of the buyer. So, and they would have to pay for all sorts of additional taxes, premiums, basically pay for your social services, social security. And the risk for you as a contractor is you lose all the company benefits that you had, all sorts of tax deductions that you'd have to pay back. So it's definitely painful for both. In your case, if you're an American company buying services abroad, I don't think the American company would have a lot of risk in this case.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so, but the remote work is a big thing, but it's not the main thing. So I would imagine that if I was consulting with a company in the Netherlands, I wonder if this conversation would come up in the initial sales
interview.
Probably not. Yeah.
What is interesting is I also have liability insurance of all sorts, including. If I delete the wrong files, I'm also covered. Right. It specifically excludes the US. So for some reason, I'm not allowed to do business with the US. But
your insurance doesn't cover company clients in the US?
Yeah.
Interesting. We must seem like a litigious bunch.
It seems to be a lot of these companies do that. And I did ask them for quotes and they never got back to me on that either.
Interesting. Yeah. When I was touching people's, production database systems, I had the same thing. I had errors in emissions insurance for, I think, $2 million. And in fact, if you work for a big company, at least me working in the US for big companies in the US, they would insist that you had that before you even they would even consider hiring you.
It's all part of the contract nowadays.
Right. Right. Well, geez, I don't know if we have anything else to talk about here. I guess raising the raising the alarm is a little bit too extreme, but pointing this out and putting it on people's radar so that if the conversation comes up in a sales meeting, you'd be able to say, oh, well, you know, these three criteria, I clearly meet all three of these criteria, so you have nothing to worry about.
I mean, we can go into a lot of detail what kind of criteria. There are some interesting ones. One that you probably didn't think about is embedding. So if the kind of work you do is being done by another employee of company, that's one thing to watch out for. Another thing is if you're actually given a company email and joined into company parties and that sort of thing, they could also see you as an employee. So all of a sudden, I'm no longer invited to the Christmas drinks, I suppose. But one of the other interesting takeaways is, so you've been obviously talking about these subjects a long time. A lot of the advice you're giving is now also coming from our IRS. So they're telling us you shouldn't really have one client. You should have several because it makes good business sense other than complying with the tax code. Your clients telling you exactly what to do isn't great business sense. You're the expert. You should sell them a service and implement it the way you think works best. Mm-hmm. It's just refreshing to see that kind of advice from the IRS.
Yeah, I don't know if I should be alarmed to be in alignment with an IRS, but I'm glad to see it. It puts almost some teeth behind the what I would consider just sort of smart business advice. It's like a government body being like making it enforceable, which is wild.
What I find interesting about this whole situation is that the law has been with us for more than 8 years now. They only decided to really enforce it now. They probably have like a dozen of people that will actually do the enforcement. So it's not like they'll be auditing everybody. Just for reference, our country has about 18 million souls. Out of which I believe there was some number like 1 million were as contractors, independent, etc. They're not going to be knocking on everybody's door in the next few years. But the interesting part of this dynamic is just the fact that they will caused everybody to go into panic and basically just lock the market overnight.
Yeah, I mean, in California, I think they were even referring to it as the gig worker law. So obviously if any enforcement, they're going to go after the big players first.
That's what they're going to do over here as well. So a lot of the work we do, and in my case as well with these bigger companies, always goes through a few, what do you call them, intermediaries, I suppose, that give them off your hourly wage, of course.
For the government contracts or those?
Yeah, so the government contracts, all the hourly work, usually there's an intermediary because larger clients don't want to have contracts with a lot of small companies, which kind of makes sense.
So is the contractor/employee conversation, does that happen with the intermediary?
Yeah, and they're the ones on the hook. Technically, so they're also the ones enforcing the law now and really making sure that the contracts are good, that it doesn't look like you're being an employee because they're the ones that end up paying for it.
Interesting. Okay, so that's another thing to look out for, dear listener. So if you're doing potentially if you're doing work through an agency or you're subcontracting through a government contractor who has the key relationship or the primary relationship with the government, then that might be another thing. Well, this probably would have already happened to anybody that is listening at this point, because it was 2019 that it happened here. And I don't know about the enforcement angle, but I remember there was a flurry of activity in my various communities about the law when it either, I don't remember if it was when it was written into law or when it be, if, if there was some date when it began to be enforced, but people freaked out about it for a little while, and then I haven't heard from about it again.
Yeah, and again, you know, this was causing a lot of friction in the market, and I believe they already toned down the message somewhat, like, oh, we're really going after the bad actors. And I didn't have time to read the news, but I saw something on LinkedIn earlier that there was another lawsuit about this that further clarifies things.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, there's the law, and there's the actual application of the law, and that right. usually changes. And that would have been a question for me to you. So you mentioned the California law. Does it mm-hmm. have any funny acronym?
AB5. I don't know what it stands for. Yeah, AB5. And it's the ABC test, just to confuse things. The ABC test is the three criteria that the seller has to meet all three criteria to not be considered an employee.
Right. Well, you're in Rhode Island, right? Mm-hmm. Did this law ever affect you in doing your work?
No. I think people, for people who are operating at what I would consider a pure consulting level, like a true consulting altitude, this is something that might come up in a conversation, but it's probably not going to affect anyone, no matter where they are, based on at least these two laws. But there's a huge portion of freelancers who fall into that group that I described as myself being in, say, 2006, 2007.
Right.
Where I was still doing a lot of coding. I was incorporated. I probably still would have been immune to this, but there is a huge number of people who are really employees in consultants' clothing. They just call themselves consultants. They're really getting bossed around. It's not like a partnership. It's more like an employee-employer relationship.
Yeah, temporary work.
Right.
Especially in a country like the Netherlands, where if you hire somebody, you're stuck with them. That's kind of harsh, but maybe for the American listener. So in a lot of American states, employment is at will, which basically means for as long as you want. And as long as you're not firing somebody because they're part of a protected class, and that's the reason, I believe, you're fine, right?
I believe so.
So in the Netherlands, we have very strong worker protections, which I think is a very good thing, by the way. And in general, you can have a few temporary contracts, and after a few of them, they have to offer you a permanent contract, in which case, while permanent sounds very harsh, but firing somebody really becomes harder after that point.
In sort of corporate America, there's a, I don't know if it's legally enforced, but generally speaking, there's a process for letting someone go that, sort of three strikes, you're out, warnings and write-ups. And if you want to protect yourself, if the employer wants to protect themselves from getting sued, like my one corporate job in my whole life, I was exposed to people who were fired, who felt they were fired wrongly, and who are, sued, and managers is like a big mess. There's a certain amount of fear in a big company that terminated employees are going to be disgruntled and lawyer
up. But yeah, so a lot of projects, and to use the programmers as another example, have a requirement for maybe 2 or 3 years of more personnel. But if you can't hire them for 2 or 3 years, I mean, contracts are limited to how long you can have somebody as a temporary employee. It opened up the market to a lot of people that sell their time hourly. Add scarcity to it, you get the mess that we were in. So I can kind of see that, and I see a lot of freelancers also fighting this change, probably because they like the way it works. I don't feel bad about that. But when I saw this back in 2016, I kind of also wanted to make myself less vulnerable to this law, but also to the market, I suppose. Having several clients is just better than having one big client.
Right. Yeah. So if you needed more, more encouragement, dear listener, the IRS in various countries is giving you that encouragement.
Yeah.
You should be doing it anyway because of the predictability that Barry mentioned way at the beginning. It's, you know, the feast famine cycle is nauseating. It's horrible. Yes. And if you have all of your eggs in one basket, especially one basket, but even if you have two whale clients, it's probably a lot. I mean, it's definitely a lot better to have more from that sort of predictability standpoint. And, you know, friend of the show, Blair Enns would say, and I think David C. Baker would say, you know, you don't want more than 20% of your revenue coming from any one client. So, you know, that means at least five.
Right. I still have work to do in that area, but you know, I'm chipping away at it.
Right. Yeah. You don't want to be beholden to one case, but imagine like it's not the greatest working relationship or they're having you do, there's just so many reasons. Like you might want to let them go. They might want to let you go. Project is over. The need is gone. Some things change. It's not going to be forever. So, it's just smart. It's just a way to make your business more resilient, more durable.
Yeah. And it also helps with building your skills. I mean, if you stay at one place too long, you become stagnant.
Yeah.
I can bring a lot of different experiences onto different jobs because I work in different places.
So like I have lots of colleagues and friends who have come to me over the years, you know, they're my age. So in my 50s and they've been at either one client for 10, 20 years or at an employer for 10 or 20 years. And for whatever reason, they're back on the job market, whether they want it to be or not. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh my God, I'm a dinosaur. Like, I don't even understand what is happening in the software space anymore. And so it's super important to keep your saw sharp, to keep your expertise, well, to maintain your expertise. And so it's just another reason we're piling on, of course, pig piling on top of the soapbox that I'm usually on anyway. But if even the government knows you should, maybe it's time to start thinking about it.
Yeah, totally. And they also want you to market your services. That's also something that they check for.
Right. It's a sign that you have a business. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and they ended that conversation. So they had a webinar and they said, you know, just don't take our word for it. It's all good business sense as well. And it's true.
I mean, it's
just refreshing to see that from the IRS, but I suppose they had, you know, they kind of benefit as well. If you're doing a great job, you bring in more revenue. So.
Right. Yeah. Good stuff. All right, Barry, where could people go if they wanted to get in touch with you to find out more about what you're doing?
So I have, unfortunately, website in Dutch, so that's not very helpful. I'm also on LinkedIn.
Yes, I know I have listeners who speak Dutch, so.
Yeah, so they can go to my website, www.coffeesprout.nl, and they can also find me on LinkedIn. I love talking about this stuff.
Cool.
I also love talking about technical stuff. That's kind of why I went from development into infrastructure, because it allows me to work on more technical things.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure there are going to be folks who are interested to contact you to pick your brain a little bit about the transition to the kinds of services that you're offering now and how you handle scope and all sorts of things. Because it's a transition that I think a lot of people listening are open to, but it's for every different space, the path can look a little different.
True. I do help people when they have questions about this, and I generally also step onto the soapbox once in a while and tell people that hourly billing is bad. So thanks for that, Jonathan.
My pleasure. Spreading the message. Okay, folks. That's it for this week. I'm Jonathan Stark, and I hope you join me again next time on Ditching Hourly. Bye. Hey, Jonathan again. Do you have questions about how to improve your business? Things like value pricing your work instead of billing for your time, or positioning yourself as the go-to person in your space, or maybe productizing your services so you never have to have another awkward sales call or spend hours writing another custom proposal. Book a one-on-one coaching call with me and get answers to these questions and others in the time it takes you to get ready for work in the morning. Best of all, you're covered by my 100% satisfaction guarantee. If at the end of the call you don't feel like it was worth it, just say the word and I'll refund your purchase in full. To book your one-on-one coaching call, go to jonathanstark.com/call, C-A-L-L. That URL again is jonathanstark.com/call. Hope to see you there.